Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
And welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Joel Morris.
I'm Jason Hazley.
As usual, we're joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. By taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works, or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we think we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is Danielle Ward. Danielle is an award-winning comedy writer and is probably best known in this room for coming up with the excellent panel game Dilemma, chairing Do the Right Thing, the podcast panel game, and also for doing something which we couldn't do and writing Danger Mouse, a project we walked away from because it was too hard. And Danielle has these scars to prove she survived the mouse.
Yeah, I've done it. It's hard. It's a hard job.
It's very tough.
It really is, isn't it?
Anything within an American exec team is a hard job.
How long are those eps? 11 minutes? Are they something like that? Yeah, we spent 7 months on an 11-minute script and didn't get it away. It just, we couldn't do it.
We tried to give them the money back.
A friend of ours, I won't say his name, but a friend of ours that we all know, ended up getting paid twice for a script because they asked him to do so many redrafts of it.
Wow.
They've got a very high bar because it's American animation. They tend to behave as if you're working for Pixar.
But not Pixar money.
Yeah, you're doing it for CBBC money. Animation for kids is now so good and the scripts are so good that it's a very competitive market. I think I remember being told that they got Brian Truman, who devised the original scripts for Danger Mouse, in as a consultant originally. And they said, well, how did you write the scripts back in the day? And he went, I went to the pub, I had 3 pints, and I wrote, toilets invade London, and then they made it the next day. You've made it too difficult.
Yes, it's a hard job, but it's a rewarding job. There's a couple of scripts of mine coming out that I'm really proud of. So
I think it's a job I wanted to do so badly. I really angled for Danger Mouse. And I think my inner 10-year-old was so ashamed when we didn't manage to do it. It's one of the few jobs we've ever walked away from because we found it so hard.
When I was 4 years old, I had, you know, those little moulds, the silicone moulds that you'd pour plaster of Paris into and paint.
Shaker maker.
I had the Danger Mouse set. I loved Danger Mouse as a kid. I was obsessed with him.
It was one of the best shows growing up because it was written like proper comedy.
Yeah.
It wasn't a kid's show.
It has a lot of bad puns. The old ones are just all bad puns. That's all it is.
Bad puns and long sequences in the dark with blinking eyes.
Yeah, I like that.
Danielle, what have you brought for us to look at today?
So I have brought a sitcom that I absolutely love. And whenever I say to myself, oh, I really like American sitcom, I don't really... What British sitcoms do I like? And then I remember that my favourite sitcom of all time is probably Bottom.
This is brilliant news.
I love Bottom. It's so good.
What is it about Bottom that makes it float to the top?
I think more than anything, it's the performances. Because if you look at the scripts are weird. There's loads of really weird jokes in there and lots of really bad jokes and lots of really old jokes. But it's so self-contained. I mean, I always think of Bottom as being two guys in a flat and that's all it is. And what? Like, you'd never do that now. I know it sounds ridiculous to say brave, because it wasn't. It was just them dicking about on a on a set for in front of an audience, which is what they used to do. But having this, basically, two very strange characters who are horrible and grubby and weird in completely different ways in a flat, just doing nothing... I mean, it's Beckett for kids. That's how I consider
it. It is, you're right, you're right. When we went back and looked at that episode, Culture, which is the one where they have had their TV repossessed by Rumbelows.
Yeah.
Although, in fact, they find it behind the fridge later. And they just try and find things to do. And it really is. It's so Beckett. This is an absolutely blank page and we're not going to achieve anything by the end of it. It's
yeah.
Wonderful.
We've only got five pieces.
We can use other things for the missing pieces.
Oh, great idea!
Now, let's see. We need 16 prawns. Well, we're in luck there. We've got a bag in the freezer that are 4 years past their sell-by date. We can use those.
Oh, chess. God, I adore chess. I should have been a chess champion. If I'd spent my whole life learning how to play chess better than anyone else in the world, I could have been the chess champion.
The reason I chose that episode, I don't want to jump in on the quotes, but it has my favourite bit ever in any sitcom ever, which is the whole, we could play pin the tail on the donkey. We haven't got a donkey. It's just amazing till they get to pin the sausage on the fridge. We haven't got a sausage.
Stick some sellotape on the fridge.
I love that bit so much. Going back, I've seen every episode of Bottom so many times and it still makes me laugh out loud, which I think is the key. In a way, like, it's a real shame actually that we've moved away from audience sitcoms, because as a kid, I think you need the guidance of an audience laughter track to understand comedy.
Mm. Yes.
Which is why I think so many... Well, it's why I think Mrs. Brown's Boys is so popular with all ages, because if you're like 7 years old and it's your first venture into actual comedy rather than kids' TV comedy, you need that laughter to know that that's a joke.
I mean, I wanted to talk about this because this is very much an audience sitcom, and it's from an age of audience sitcom where the people who were doing it had done lots of it. I mean, one of the things that I think is the problem with doing audience sitcom now is that not enough people have had enough practice to be brilliant at it.
Yeah.
And this is Rick Mayall and Ade Edmondson, who have done lots of this, but then it's directed by Ed Bye, who directed The Young Ones and knows how to direct huge, complicated, one-take slapstick sequences for a live audience.
Yeah.
You'd never do it that way now.
Yeah, it would just be, let's have two cameras for coverage. I mean, that's what all... I get a bit frustrated with the BBC audience sitcom system of, you know, let's just stick some cameras on it. Like, there's no artistry to the directing. In fact, someone said to me, if you want to have a career at the BBC, become a live studio audience director, because it's one of them.
We were talking a while ago about how to bring back that feeling of pace and shape that you get in an audience sitcom. And it comes from people who are experienced at vision mixing, yeah. Which is the thing. People edit now. They edit, they take the film and then they cut it up like a film. Whereas back in the day, these people had trained on Top of the Pops and Blue Peter and things, and they knew how to edit in camera live. And the only time I've seen that skill done since is we spent a day with the crew who make Educating Essex and Educating Yorkshire. And they edit a lot of those storylines with the multi-cameras around the school live, because the data would take up too much space.
Yeah.
And I was watching them going, you are editing this like a sitcom. This is done like The Good Life. You're telling a story by cutting between two shots and one shots. And those guys, I think, can probably direct a sitcom if you drag them out of reality TV. They're quite good.
Wow, that's interesting.
Which had never occurred to me. Yeah. I think that skill still exists, but it's probably on Big Brother.
Yeah.
But not in comedy.
Something that people might not know, so we'll just flag it up here because it's worth knowing about, is that when you do a sitcom like Bottom, you will have five cameras in the studio, and Ed, the director, will have gone through the script and will have put every single camera cut in for the vision mixer to play it. So he knows every single shot before they start filming.
Mm.
It's a hell of a lot of work. It's a really big job, and when you do it as well as he does it here, hats off.
Yeah, I mean, this is what is frustrating with British comedy at the moment, is that when audience sitcom is done well, there is nothing like it, and we all know that. But Bottom is so weird. I think that's what's missing from modern sitcom, is that to make an audience sitcom, there's the idea that it has to be really accessible and boring and a family, so you've got the kids who can't act. I mean, why would you put kids in an audience sitcom? Don't know, have adults who can do it. But Bottom and Blackadder, but Bottom especially, and The Young Ones, such a weird setup. If if you were making Bottom Now, you would make it as a single camera sitcom.
Yes.
Because
yes.
it would be about, it would basically be Peep Show.
It would be fucking dark as yes. well, wouldn't it?
It would be so dark. I mean, it's part of the reason that I loved Bottom so much growing up. Because I remember that, I think it was on a Thursday at 9 o'clock on BBC Two. And the 9 o'clock on BBC Two was always the sitcom slot. So it was Bottom, or it was Red Dwarf, or it was Blackadder. That was the slot. And it was, you all talked about it next day at school. Bottom was such an influence on me and my friends at school that I have a friend called Katie who still says things like "Ahoy, matey," and things like that, and "Cheerio," and she talks exactly like Eddie. Like whenever she's saying "Skip, matey, me old chum," she'll talk like that when she's talking to you. She is married to a sailor though, as well.
It's excusable. Yeah. Did she deliberately marry a sailor so this wouldn't look weird?
I think so. Yeah. So it was such a big influence, but you'd watch it on a Thursday night, and then the next day you'd all be in talking about it. And it was because as a kid, it's weird. And I know it's not very, I shouldn't be saying this as a woman, but I absolutely love comic violence on screen. Like, I remember the first time I saw Salad Days, the amazing Monty Python sketch yeah. where they all have bits cut off.
Yep.
That Kenny Everett, when I used to, my favourite Kenny Everett sketches were, and I'm too young to really appreciate the actual sketches, but I used to love the DIY
Reg
ones.
Reg Prescott.
Yes.
Where he'd cut his arm off.
He'd cut his arm off and things like that. And, like, there's an episode of Bottom where Eddie has both of his legs cut off and sewn on backwards. Like, you can't do that in a single camera sitcom.
Yes, I suppose one of the things that helps it is that it's not really happening.
Yeah.
Because it's obviously on a set.
Yeah. It's a live-action cartoon, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's
it
what's
is,
going
yeah,
on.
Scratch.
It's like
yeah.
it's like Roadrunner or something. Yeah. It's basically these two characters will never achieve the thing they set out to achieve, and we'll come back and watch them again and again and again. It's endless iterations of the same thing, isn't it?
Because it's a cartoon, it's not real. You can do stuff in it that if you're in a single-camera sitcom and you were supposed to think these people were the guys from Peep Show,
yeah.
the sexism would be unacceptable.
Yeah.
The disgusting behaviour would be unacceptable. But the joy of this is that the stuff comes, is a performer's show. It's not yeah. necessarily a writer's show. But it does have that joy of saying anything they write down can go straight from the typewriter to the stage, to the audience, to the screen, to the kid at home.
Yeah.
There's no limits on it, and there's no limits on it because it isn't really happening.
But you say it's not a writer's show, but then there will be some lines. I think it's the Christmas one where Dave Hedgehog and
it's a writer's show because there's a character called Dave Hedgehog yeah. in it, for a start.
Spud Gunn and Dave Hedgehog come round, and and like there's a bit where Richie just refers to him as "you anus." And it's just things like that. That's such a perfect word.
And the pilot episode opens in pure sort of Galton and Simpson territory. They're coming back a bit like Sid and Tony Hancock or Steptoe. And they go into the horrible flat and Richie looks out the window and does this monologue about everyone in London having sex except him that is pure Hancock.
Yeah.
And that is really good writing and it's a good performance. He's written for a tone that he can perform. But that's a pure bit of writing. I'm not saying, when I say it's not a writer's show, that it's not well written.
Yeah.
More, these are performers writing for themselves rather than what you might think of as a show that's written for the page.
I know exactly what you mean. What is interesting is nowadays when you see the performer-writer thing, that it tends to not be the best sitcoms. No, that sounds awful. But I sometimes think that, I don't know if it's because people are given like enough rope to hang themselves, but I say that. I mean, you know, look at, I watched Dark Place recently, and that is so beautifully written. So maybe I'm getting it
it's
wrong.
It's because he's playing a writer.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is. But I know what you mean, because I guess because we're writers who aren't performers. Well, I mean, we're all, but you know, we're never going to get our own sitcom where we are the helm.
Dream on.
I get this too. I'm like, so I look at the American shows where it is very much like Arrested Development, which I love, or Community, where there's that person who's the writer and then they get these amazing actors. And so I never really think of someone who absolutely loves that writer-performer relationship. Sometimes it feels a little bit too like, who had a good Edinburgh? Let's give them a sitcom. And there's a lot of that around at the moment. But I never think of that with Bottom. I never think of it as being these guys that have written for themselves. It almost, when I watch it, it's really easy for me to imagine that there were other writers, because I think it's so brilliantly written. It's good, it's almost like they didn't write it themselves.
It's almost like they got a professional in. I think what it's got in it is it's got a voice. And the voice it's got is their voice. It's the voice of those two guys talking to each other down the pub or in their office or wherever they write. And what that can sometimes be because a writer performer is writing for themselves.
Yeah.
And it can sometimes be because a writer really understands the voice of their lead actor, like, again, Gorton and Simpson or Eddie Braben with Morecambe Wise, that the writer has got into the soul of their performers. And it's something I think that this has in common with Peep Show, is that Sam and Jesse understand David and Rob's voices so well. And I used to be really jealous. I'm going, love Peep Show and I love Sam and Jesse's writing. And I was really jealous of how effortlessly they appear to have been able to write something that two other performers could just perform as if that was them talking. And I mentioned this to a friend who knows David and Rob and knows Sam and Jesse, and he went, what you've got to remember is that Sam and Jesse talk like David and Rob. One of them is David and one of them is Rob. And they've accidentally found these avatars.
Yeah.
So when they just talk to each other in the office, that's the voice they're going to use for the show. And it's that seamlessness that Bottom's got. This is how Rick Mayall and Adrian Edmondson talk to each other when they're being silly.
Yeah, and one of the things I find so amazing about Bottom is, as a writer, I have looked into some of the key ideas about writing. I remember once going to a workshop. Paul Mayhew-Archer did this brilliant thing, and it was talking about status, which I'd never really thought of. I think when you first start writing, you don't really think about the technique involved. And it was all about the status of characters, which I do think is hugely important to sitcom.
This is high status and low status.
High status and low status, or even just different status. Like, people have to have different and the status relationships. So I do a bit of work for the writer's room at the BBC, and I gave some notes once about how, if you look at something like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, there's a real status at play. So you've got Dennis, who is high status. You've got Mac, who thinks he's the same status as Dennis, but isn't. You've got Charlie, who absolutely understands that he is low status. And then you've got Dee, who doesn't want to play the status game, but if anything, is sometimes even below Charlie. And it can change around, but generally we all know that Dennis is high status and Mac is doing that and Charlie's low status and all that sort of thing. And I do think that's so important for sitcom. And what is brilliant about Bottom is their statuses switch all the time in a way that doesn't really happen in sitcom.
I remembered vaguely, I haven't seen Bottom for ages, I remembered that Rick Mayall was Alpha, was the high status guy, the dreamer, the Hancock, and that Adrian Edmondson was playing a lower status, sort of slightly more Father Dougally clown.
Yeah.
But Rick's ignorant and Adrian Edmondson is clever.
Yeah.
He knows stuff. One of them's a virgin, one of them is sexually experienced.
Yeah.
Their statuses are constantly changing because they're a double act who've played this game on stage a lot.
I mean, look. Look all around you. It's Friday night. And everywhere you look, there's buildings full of people all doing it. All doing it and doing it and then stopping and having a fag and then doing it a bit more. There's not a single one of them saying, hang on a minute, this really isn't fair. I mean, here's us doing it and doing it and doing it, and there's poor old Richie and he hasn't done it. Ever. He hasn't got anyone to do it to. I'll tell you what, I'll pop down and do it to him for a bit and then pop back up. Would that be all right?
I remember learning about status and going, this is dynamite, because it gives the audience clues as to what to expect.
Yeah.
And audiences like to guess what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
And status helps you know that.
They both think that they're high status at a certain point. Richie, in particular, is brilliant because, like with the culture episode, he loves the fact that they haven't got a TV because he can be cultured for the evening.
Yeah.
And he gets it so wrong because he doesn't know anything. But he really reminds me of people in my family that if you took... we would love to not have a television. And they go insane because all they do is watch ITV. It's so beautifully observed, but also brilliantly played out. But it's such a complicated character. It's not, there's an idea that if you do sitcom, you have to have very big archetypes. And, you know, the whole thing about the Friends pilot, they walk in and you know that Monica is obsessed with cleaning and Ross is the every guy and Rachel's the pretty one. With Bottom, they are both really complicated characters.
It's very dynamic, isn't it? It's like watching a game of tennis, actually, is what it is, because it's just two people in kind of competition with each other, both in character and out of character. I wanted to mention the sit of the sitcom as well, because there's a thing in sitcom which is that your characters should ideally be trapped by something they have done. So Basil Fawlty doesn't want to be running this hotel, but he went along with it, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Fletcher is in prison, but he's there because he did something wrong.
Yeah.
And occasionally in sitcom, you do something called a bottle episode, where you confine the characters to the smallest possible space and don't let them get out. And it's a writing exercise. There's a nice episode of One Foot in the Grave where he's stuck in a traffic jam.
Yeah.
So all it is just the two of them in the car. This feels like this entire sitcom is a bottle.
Yeah.
It feels like it's the biggest, tightest trap. So the only thing these two characters can do is just bounce off the walls with each other.
Yeah. It's so unlike any other sitcom.
It gets smaller. We watched the pilot, and the pilot, we counted 5-6 sets. There's a pub, there's a sex shop with Kevin McNally in it.
Oh, yeah.
There's some toilets. And by the time we get to series two, they're just in that flat set.
Yeah.
And it's like watching a stage play.
In the episode that we looked at, they don't leave the room, do they?
No.
It's just one room.
That's why I think that's such a fascinating episode, because that's what I think of Bottom as being. Even though there are episodes where they go and do other stuff, I think of it as being two guys in a flat. The other brilliant Bottle episode is the one where at the fairground when they're on the Ferris wheel. And whole episode is two men on a Ferris wheel.
But that shows enormous confidence as performers to know that you've had experience that audiences will just watch you.
Yeah.
And you know you can be funny enough to fill half an hour quite effortlessly that way.
Yeah.
The shadow that's cast over this is the young ones. And I think, interestingly, we sat trying to work out the structure because we were trying to work out whether they're high or low status. And then we ran it past the other test, which is Mitch Hurwitz's, who wrote Arrested Development, his theory about matriarch, patriarch, craftsman and clown.
That
basically, he says the Beatles are the best example. Paul's the matriarch, John's the patriarch, George's the craftsman, Ringo's the clown. And it works in a lot of sitcoms. And the way you can change the balance of a sitcom is to remove one of those elements. So The Simpsons are matriarch, patriarch, craftsman and clown. Yeah. But in this one, they've taken out the matriarch and the patriarch.
Yeah.
There's no mum and dad. Neil, who was the mum in The Young Ones, and Mike, who was the dad, have gone. And the two feuding kids, one of whom is wants to better themselves, who thinks that their life could be better, and one who is happy down there. You've got there craftsman and clown, and you feel the absence of mum and dad. I worry for them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just, again, that's why it is so unlike anything else I've ever seen. Like, the more, like, when I watched it when I was younger, I thought Bottom was just really funny. All the slapstick, all the really stupid jokes, all the like amazing performances. It sounds like I'm more siding with Rick Mayall, like, in terms of the big performances, but obviously they're both fantastic. But I can't remember which episode it is where he's so bored that he pretends that he's taking this really serious phone call. They're just things like that. It's just absolutely brilliant.
When you go closer on his face, I mean, they both got good eyes.
Yeah.
They're both at their most beautiful at this point, aren't they?
They are trying to be disgusting, but they're both beautiful.
Yeah.
You go in close on their eyes and let their eyes fill the screen, and they really perform straight down the lens of the camera. And you watch the way that Rick Mayall, say in the Gas Man episode, drinks the tea made with hot tap water, and it's all in his eyes.
Yeah. When I was younger, I think of Bottom as being this throwaway slapstick stupidness, but actually there's like real loneliness and pain and weirdness and mental illness and all that sort of stuff all wrapped up in this sitcom in a way that you don't get with My Family.
One of the things that hadn't occurred to me, I thought, well, there are these two terrible scroats who will, you know, drink Mazola and eat lard and things like that, but they're both wearing ties the whole time.
Yes.
And stuff like that. They're quite well dressed, aren't they?
They've got standards.
Just remembered another thing, that like there's a real beautiful rhythm to a lot of the writing as well. Because I watched Culture this morning before coming out, and I'd forgotten about the Perno, Ouzo, Marmalade and Salt. Just rhythmically, that's funny. That's a funny line.
It is. Good comedy is music, though, isn't it? You know, you've got to get the notes right.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Also, the props in this. I mean, there are so many good prop gags in it. I was looking up the props by Bob Warren. He's done the props for absolutely everything. He got a special BAFTA last year for his services to TV. Yeah, because he's just made tons of props that are going to get smashed to shit, aren't they?
You keep looking at those scenes. They're all spiritual cousins of the bit in The Young Ones when Rick goes down the banisters.
Yeah.
And each banister rod comes off around his knackers. They've all been, I imagine, pre-filmed and then played into the audience to get the rhythm that Ed Bye gives them. But still, they would have had one shot at filming this because Bob Warren's will have built one of all these things. So when they smash a chair, they better capture that moment.
It's interesting you mentioned The Young Ones. So I watched The Young Ones, but I don't think I've seen The Young Ones anywhere near as much as I've seen Bottom either. So it's not even like, not that I'm not into The Young Ones, it's just one of those sitcoms that sort of passed me by. So now when I look back on The Young Ones, for me it's a not as good version of Bottom.
I think it was the other way around for us. We were so obsessed by The Young Ones that this looked like a slightly more simplistic film of The Young Ones with Mike and Neil missing. And actually, watching it again, I'm now appreciating it as a thing on its own that has got Beckett-y qualities and also just pure clowning. Also, more sense and cogency. The Young Ones gets its reputation from, I think, the general joy of the thing and the fact that no one had done it before. And also, probably two or three episodes that have got proper sitcom structure that you remember very, very fondly. And otherwise, it's just delicious chaos.
Yeah.
What's great about this is it's quite tight.
Yeah, I think even at the time, I remember that when Bottom first came out, there was a real sort of, oh, it's just a rehash of The Young Ones. I think that is what the press, or at least just people that I knew that were a bit older than me, like, that was the idea. Bottom is just not as good as The Young Ones. But I think it stands up as an amazing sitcom. Just remembered another, just talking about bits that I really like now. A thing that I really, really love in sitcoms, and Peep Show do it as well, is when one character really loves Christmas and the other one doesn't love Christmas. It's one of my favourite things. I think it's so funny. The Christmas episode where he comes in, he's so excited because it's Christmas. And I love that episode of Peep Show as well.
It's great, isn't it?
Jess is just like, it's Christmas. And Mark's like, oh, God. But it's like the most perfect bit of status play, I think. If you ever want to explain status play to a new writer, the character who loves Christmas and the character who hates Christmas is the perfect way of doing it.
Status is a really interesting thing because it's one of those keys to the cupboard of comedy you get given and you go, oh, does everyone else know this? I remember being taught it quite late by someone who'd gone and studied it at drama college or something. They told me about this and we've used it to get work before because we do work occasionally for advertising. You get asked to help to punch up scripts for adverts.
Yeah.
And the thing that no one in advertising knows is status.
Yeah.
And you said that because the thing in advertising, the client always wants everyone to win. We've got these two guys and they both get the girl because they drink our product. And you went, well, one of them has to not get the girl.
Yeah. I'm so obsessed with status. Like whenever I try and sit and like write either a spec script or if I've been commissioned to write something that isn't my own project, because obviously when it's a project that already exists, like Danger Mouse, you know, I already know the relationship between Danger Mouse and Penfold. When you go into it and you're trying to come up with it, the first thing I do is work out the statuses or even just the starting point of people's statuses or where they think they are, because the interesting thing about Eddie and Richie is they both think that they're higher status than each other, even if they're not. See, I the other way around from you, I always saw Eddie as the high status one.
Yeah. He's clever.
Yeah, and Richie is, because Richie's an absolute idiot. But there are some episodes where it all flips round. And the way I sit down is I go, who is my central character? Who is higher than them? Who is lower than them? Who thinks it's the other way round? And I just always start from that point.
Thinking it's the other way round is really good. We looked into this when we got offered the Danger Mouse gig.
Yeah.
The first question you go, well, this guy's a superhero. The song at the beginning says he's the best in the world. So you go, he's high status. Then the next question is, well, what bad can happen to him?
Yeah.
Being too brave. I mean, you have to rinse these things to get any plots out of someone who is high status and happy being high status.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of prefer writing the Penfold plots because Penfold's more complicated. Because Danger Mouse is high status and he's good at what he does. And so you're basically knocking him off a pedestal every time. Whereas Penfold is insecure. But he's really good. If you put him in a situation, he can be the really excellent one. But he doesn't believe he can be. And no one else believes he can be. But you can have a character that does believe in him. And there's so much more to play with a complicated status than there is with just, hey, this person's brilliant.
The one I always liked was, if you watch Police Squad, You remember Frank Drebin being a clumsy, klutzy cop. But he's not. He's high status. He's the best cop in the whole city. He can solve all the crimes. He's amazing. He's a super Adam West, lantern-jawed hero. And when they make the films of it, when they make the Naked Gun films, he's a different character. He's low status. He's like Inspector Clouseau. He's falling over all the time. They've run out of jokes to play with a high status detective, and they've gone for a low status detective.
I don't know either of them. I didn't know Rick Mayall. I don't know Aid Edmondson. I don't know anybody who works with them. So I don't know whether they were easy to work with or whether it was the most difficult thing in the world getting on. And part of me doesn't even want to know, to be honest, because I like to be able to sit back and just go, this is an incredible... These are incredible performances with brilliant, mad ideas behind them. I mean, there are... Like the gas man episode. They basically just had to kill the gas man.
And then eat him.
And eat him. I mean, what? That's just... Because they've been stealing gas. That's all it is. They're just stealing gas. That's the only reason why they want to kill any... Or the burglar episode where they tape him to the ceiling. I mean...
What's the real fun of this? Maybe this is what's so liberating about watching it, is that no one said no.
Yeah.
You get the feeling that at any point when they went, okay, so Rick Mayall's going to go down with a knife and fork and attempt to eat a dead gas man.
Yeah.
No one's gone, are you sure? And the sheer energy of the performance and the confidence says, I can sell this to the audience. Again, there's a live audience there who on the night will laugh at me doing this. So trust me, we'll get in front of some people who will tell you this was the right decision. And you know that if it was a single camera sitcom and you were then sitting in a quiet edit suite editing it, someone would go, actually, can we lose? And the unarguable sound of a hysterical audience gets you over all those lumps of underconfidence.
What on earth are you eating?
Lard.
Thing that I love about Radio 4 is that it's the one place where you can still do quite weird audience sitcoms. I mean, obviously, there's still the whole commissioning process and everything, but for me, I learned how to write by doing live shows. So I started as a stand-up, and then I wrote this very odd musical that I still love called Sister Psycho, and I wrote another musical, and I wrote a play called Take a Break Tales, and these were all Edinburgh shows. So they have to work in front of an audience. And I work with Colin Holt a lot, who... There's no one I trust more with a script. Like, I know that I can give Colin Holt a script that's got four jokes in it and he'll find 12.
Yes.
He's fucking brilliant.
That's what you want, right?
Brilliant.
That is what you want from a performer. And so, you, as a writer, you write loads and loads of gags. And I, going back and watching Bottom, there's some really... There's lines in Bottom that aren't, if you read them on the page, aren't funny. But the reason that they are funny, which I think is true of all great comedy, the reason that they are funny is in the context and the performance.
And, yes.
And I think sometimes that with sitcoms that are written, if there's a distance between the writer and performer, and I say this as someone who is the writer and not the performer, when there's a distance, you can see in the eyes of the performer that they don't quite believe in the line.
Yes.
And that is where everything comes undone.
Well, that maybe ties back to your question about were they easy to work with, were they difficult to work with? I never met Rick Mayall. I did meet Aid Edmondson for the first time last year, and he was delightful. But I think the thing you can tell is going on in this show here is that they're having a fucking great time, aren't they? They're really enjoying this.
They're enjoying it, but they don't do the thing that I really hate, which is I know that we all love corpsing. I hate fake corpsing. Ooh. Like, I really hate fake corpsing.
It's cheating, isn't it?
We've seen rehearsed corpsing.
Oh.
When you see corpsing in the dry run and the rehearsal, and you go, oh God, that's going to work as well. The audience are going to fall for it.
Oh my God, look, I really hate it. And we all know it works and the audiences love it. But as a writer and as a performer, I'm like, do you know what? If you want to make each other laugh, do it for real. don't have a bit in your show where... So this is what we did with Take a Break Tales. There'd be a couple of places where I'd say to the cast, which were Neil Edmund, Emma Fryer and Izzy Sooty, I'd say, like, so one day I improvised a line, it made everybody laugh. And I said, I'm not going to do that again. Like, if you want, well, let's have bits where you can improvise. And if you want to try and get that genuine corpsing thing, let's actually do it. Let's have bits in the show where you are allowed to try and make someone else laugh, and that's absolutely fine. But don't pretend to laugh at something that you laughed at yesterday, because we're all performers. Do it for real.
And also the audience will fall for it, but it's a slightly it's not real flavour, it's artificial flavouring. It's
MSG.
Cheap. Yeah. You've added it in because of course it's nice to watch someone laugh, but also it does pull you out of the reality of the thing. I like in Bottom, that they do wink at the audience throughout it. There's a lot of to camera straight down the lens, but they never break character doing it. I think that's Eddie looking down the camera at me going, isn't this fun? Yeah. I don't think it's Adrian Edmondson.
And that's why I think the Bottom Live... So have you seen the Bottom Live show?
No, no.
It's not as good, and it's because all of it is breaking the fourth wall. Like, it's so much of it is the, oh, that's not what you said in rehearsal. Like, there's much of that, and it just makes you go, oh, this isn't Bottom. This isn't what... Like, I totally buy into these two characters, and now what I'm watching is Rick and Aid having fun in a live show rather than these two lost and lonely weird characters stuck in a flat in Hammersmith.
That's never occurred to me about the young ones. I never thought. There's a bit in the young ones where they all swap wigs, which is very, very funny.
Very funny. Yeah.
But I think it's the only point at which I thought that was Adrian Edmondson and Nigel Planer and mucking about. I always thought it was Neil and Vivian mucking about.
Yeah.
There's a reality to it. It's like these people have put on a play for you.
Yeah.
Which again is slightly Beckett, as in where's the edge of this play? And the play appears to have the ability to include the audience, even though these characters are real.
Yeah.
And that's magic.
So Rick and A did, they were in Godot, weren't they? They were in Waiting for Godot the same year as the pilot of Bottom. We could find this out probably, but it'd be interesting to know which project influenced the other one.
Yeah.
Or whether they were just into Beckett or something at the time. The thing that I looked up was Clowns, because of the Beckett thing. And I thought, especially because they're, as you said, they're beautiful men at this point, but they are dressed as disgusting tramps.
Yeah.
In suit and tie, like pure Chaplin. And I looked it up, and there's, in classical clowning, about which I know nothing, I've done very little research into being a clown, because it's not my job.
I know a little bit about being a clown.
Well, maybe you'll be able to tell me this. There are three types of clown in the classic clown trope. There's a hobo clown, who's like a character clown, who is sort of Father Jack. And there's the white-faced clown, who is the authority figure, who often thinks he's much grander than he is. And there's an Auguste clown, which is the red-nosed, funny one. And I was looking at this going, well, they're clowns and they're Beckett. Which clowns are they? And I thought, oh, God, they've got the white-faced one missing.
Yeah.
Father Ted isn't there. This is Dougal and Jack.
Yeah.
They're the ones who are doing disgusting bodily functions and sexual urges and a lot of winking at the audience and big honk, honk. This is the clowns without the man in charge.
Yeah.
It's chaos.
But I wonder if they ever, I wonder if they ever sat down and thought of it as academically as this.
I hope not.
I mean, I hope not as well. To be honest,
I'm ruining it.
Yeah, I'm not, but I bet they didn't. I bet it was just like, what is funny? What would be funny? What would be a funny thing for us to do? Wouldn't it be funny if we went to see a gypsy and she told us the world was going to... But because there's that Beckett thing, you sort of think there must be a bit of intellect to it. And they were both smart, they're smart guys. So I'm sure it wasn't as dissected as we're doing, but I don't think it's just, hey, let's just piss about and it just happens to create this absolutely beautiful thing.
The joy of it, especially watching an episode called Culture, is this isn't low art.
Yeah.
This has got echoes of high art in it because it's pure clowning.
I can't do clowning. It's really like to clown properly, you have to really surrender your status on stage. And as a stand-up, it's the opposite of what you always do because your job as a stand-up is to control a room. And it's really difficult to go from stand-up to being a proper clown because you have to be so vulnerable to be a clown, no matter which clown you are, because the whole point is that you're making people laugh at you and sometimes you don't know why. And as a stand-up, you're like, I've written this and I know why you're laughing at this stuff. Whereas a clown, sometimes you need to let go of all that and, you know, you can't even go, right, if I do this, this and this, people will laugh. You end up in the moment doing something and people are laughing and you don't even know why they're laughing, but it works until you go along with
That's such a good point. I'd never thought about that.
I could give you the example of Stuart Lee, who used to be still is very cerebral, but is a clown on stage.
He studied that.
Yeah, and he's really gone for the clowning.
I bumped in at the Clown Museum in Hackney when he was researching this. He did a radio show, and then his persona on stage changed in a way that lots of people didn't notice.
Yeah.
He possessed and owned his clown to an extent that he totally commanded the stage and became twice as funny.
When I saw Content Provider, because I hadn't seen, I'd seen the stuff on the TV that he'd been doing, there's moments in that show that are pure clowning in a way that I could never do where I am at the moment as a stand-up. Like, everything I do is written. It's all on the page. You could, you know, there's a bit of improvisation. There's a bit of playing with the audience. But there's moments that are... And you don't see stand-ups do it very often. Even the clowny stand-ups don't do as much clowning as Stuart Lee. Or the mate, all that repetition. Yeah. Clowning is repetition. Like, the first thing you get taught at clown school, which I have done. I went to a one-week workshop on clowning because I was really fascinated by it. The first thing they teach you is if something works in front of the audience, you do it again and you keep doing it until they stop laughing, which is Stuart Lee's entire career.
Yeah. And it's also how you treat a baby, isn't it?
Yeah.
If the baby laughs at the thing, you do it again. Peekaboo.
And that's what clowning is, repetition. That's all it is. It's doing the same thing over and over again until the audience don't find it funny anymore. But if you're Stuart Lee, you do it some more and then they come back. But even in clowning, that's kind of what they teach you.
So this is where we get to the point where they're clouting the gas man with the frying pan. We just keep doing this.
Yeah.
Which then moves into what Vic and Bob do.
Yeah.
And they are, there's no doubt when you look at those guys, you go, well, these guys have got the essence of clowns.
Yeah.
Because I cannot explain what they're doing because it's not words.
Yeah.
And as writers, it's almost embarrassing to have to admit that you have to go non-verbal and just surrender.
Yeah, I can't do it. Like, I couldn't write a bit in anything. Like, so there was a bit in Gutted where... So it was a big musical and there'd be like a bit where Colin was singing to his son about how he's given himself over to the police. And it's this long sort of beautiful bit of music that builds and builds and builds. And it was all quite instrumental, or it has like one line repeated. So on the page, it's not funny. There's no jokes in there at all. It's just Colin saying, I'll do it for him. And this music builds and the lyric is not funny. And what Colin Holt did was whenever he was doing this in front of the audience, he'd do a different bit of dancing to it, which got to the point where he'd mime driving a car. So he'd be singing this really serious thing to Doc Brown about how he loved his son, and he'd be miming driving a car around the stage. And it was the funniest thing I've ever seen. And he'd do something different every time, and the whole of the cast would be pissing themselves. That's what and it's just, I can't do that. I cannot sit there and go, there's a bit where Colin Holt pretends to be driving a car, because it doesn't even make sense within the context of the show. And that's the thing that I love about Bottom. And you can see, again, with the frying pan bit, you can see that they've probably gone hit him three times.
Yeah.
And that's getting a big laugh. So they keep hitting him and they keep hitting him until it's not getting a laugh. And then they hit him again and then they hit him some more.
Can we say a word about the titles, by the way, of this? I know that's an odd thing to bring up, but I was watching them last night again and going, these are really simple. I'd never really thought about them before, but they're great, because what you get, first of all, is two blokes who've got nowhere to go, so they're on a bench on Hammersmith Broadway, whacking each other with papers and annoying each other. Then you get them looking out of a window, and it's not a window, it's artifice. This thing doesn't exist.
It's a fake window hanging in space.
It's for what eventually became the Coca-Cola building at Hammersmith Broadway and the shopping centre. And the other thing is that the music underneath it is nearly falling apart. It's really clunky, and I sort of thought, that tells you everything you need to know about this show, doesn't it? It's kind of on the verge of collapse, it's total artifice, and these two guys are annoying each other.
Yes.
Sums up the whole thing.
And in the titles, Rick Mayall's character cries.
Yeah.
Which really, that's the thing that I always thought was so lovely. Like, it totally captures their relationship. You don't need to know anything up more than, like, he's just sobbing while being punched in the balls. Yeah.
And that bench on Hammersmith Broadway now has a plaque on it dedicated to Rick Mayall, doesn't it?
That's beautiful.
Which is lovely.
And I used to love the end titles as well, because, you know, you did the little dance at the end like
dancing
they did.
Black and white before the iPod advert.
Yes.
And that's I was watching that going, I don't know how they did that, because it's a really clever video.
It's rotoscoping.
It takes ages, because we did a spoof iPod advert for Mitchell and Webb, and Ben Gosling Fuller, the director, had to go through with a pen and trace Robert Webb dancing.
Really?
Because I said, surely there's a plugin that does this, and he went, no, it's done. I said, like Bottom and the iPod adverts, and he went, that's animation. It takes ages. You have to do it by hand. The love that's gone into this. Oh. So they care.
Oh.
And how many series were there?
Three. And the third series is a little more up and down, I think, because when it's so self-contained and you're the only two writers, the problem is that you start running out of ideas.
Yeah.
And that's why I think sometimes people think of the American system as being amazing, because they can have all these different, you know, look at some of the episodes of Community, and that's because they've got a writer's room and they've got a team coming up with stuff. If you're just two guys making each other laugh, it's really hard to sustain all these different ideas.
You will run out of steam.
Yeah.
There's a great writing technique that I think it's Paul Feig had on Freaks and Geeks, where you get the writing room together and they said, right, it's about high school. Right, I'll give you 5 minutes, write down 50 ideas of something that could happen to you at high school. Yeah. And he said the first 10 ideas were all the same.
Yeah.
He said the ones at the bottom, when people were running out of time, was unique and personal, and that's what they made all their stories out of. There were ones like, a friend had a peanut allergy. You have to mine down, dig into people, because the surface 10 stories are what we all write.
Yeah.
That's the one about one of them likes Christmas, one doesn't like Christmas.
But it's funny.
Yeah, but that's a banker. We've got that one. But it's the ones down the bottom is what I think enables you to have that many series of Cheers and that many series of The Simpsons. It's people drilling down. But the joy of most British sitcoms is it's the top 18 ideas you have.
The thing about bottom is that because it's such a kind of fucking carnival, that each episode contains dozens and dozens of ideas, doesn't it? I mean, even just down to things like, well, we haven't got a chess set, we'll say we'll have to build one out of action figures and sausages, you know, stuff like that. That's a whole set of ideas on its own.
Yeah, it's a bit like Rick and Morty in that sense. Like, the thing that I love about Rick and Morty is how many ideas are in. I mean, it's also brilliant and funny, but it's how many ideas are in there. And bottom's the same, because they've confined themselves in this way. They have to really go for the imagination and what. I mean, I don't think you would get to the place of eating a gas man.
No.
Unless you'd put yourself in a box. Because if you can have the setup of, oh, we go out for a bit and then we come back for a bit and then someone comes around, you know, all that sort of stuff. You really have to be put the fence around yourself to get those weird ideas.
They are just talking. That's all they've got. They haven't got sets. They haven't got other characters necessarily.
Yeah.
Immediately to hand. It's not like an office or a bar or a hospital. Yeah. They've got each other to play off. And so they take an idea for a walk, and maybe the joy of this is a bit like the joy of that you get with Vic and Bob, that it's two friends who've started from here and they've taken an idea for a walk, and they will go through all the ideas they have within that box. The only person who can say no to this is my best friend.
Yeah.
So we've got to trust each other on this.
Yeah, I was talking to my boyfriend. My partner.
Boyfriend.
My partner slash boyfriend. Because I think I was going to say partner and then I thought that sounds like writing partner. My partner slash boyfriend slash baby daddy. So I did a script read through for the BBC a few years ago, and it went through that casting process of, yes, we like this random person, this random person, this random person. And they're meant to be playing best friends. And I think it was a good script and I was really proud of it. But I think where it really fell down was you look at these three people like, these aren't three best friends. These do not look like they know each other. This is just the arbitrary casting process of someone at the BBC. If you're going to have that chemistry, it's got to sort of be real. That's why Peep Show is so brilliant. Like, you know, and that's also why I think something like Red Dwarf works, because I loved Red Dwarf as well, because they're meant to not like each other. So you can get two strangers, stick them together and have the antagonism. You can do that because that is the sit. If the sit is these people have known each other for a long time, or they're best friends, or they've
siblings
got
siblings or something.
Yeah, or they've got this weird relationship, and then you're just casting two random people. You're never going to find that magic.
We go back to the audience look in their eyes and see confidence.
Yeah.
And that you'll have confidence if your best friend's got your back.
Yeah.
If you're going on this adventure together, if their best mate is going to back them up. If I say something stupid like I'm going to eat the gas man.
Yeah.
That your best mate looks into the audience and says, I dare you to say that guy's not brilliant. You see in their eyes they're confident in each other and they're going to take this journey together. And you can't fake that by bunging just some people who happen to be to share an agent together.
Yeah, the chemistry, I guess, is really fascinating. I always loved Double X when I was younger. The first thing I ever went to see live was Cannon and Ball when I was 9 years old. I was obsessed with Cannon and Ball. I loved
experience.
Them.
Formative.
But if you ever watch Cannonball, now they're still really funny. If you watch any Cannonball, there's no material. It's just a relationship.
Right.
I mean, it's very much straight man, funny man, which I don't think Bottom is. I think it's two very funny people, which again is why it's really different from a lot
of
those
Eddie
things.
Eddie Brave and Eric and Ernie. There's two funny men.
Yeah, and same with Peep Show as well. They're both funny. You don't have... There's no Martin Freeman. Not that Martin Freeman isn't funny, I've said. Yeah. Or his character in The Office, you know. There's no straight character in this. They're both really funny. Cannon and Ball. Tommy Cannon isn't funny. Bobby Ball is really funny, but the whole thing that works is their relationship. And when that does work, I don't know why we don't utilise that more in sitcom. I don't know why. And that's why Mrs Brown's Boys works. I mean, that is why it works. It's because it's an existing relationship and they all know and they've all got each other. listeners back, and they trust that, and they trust that if something doesn't work, then no one's going to be hung out to dry and made to look like a prick. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work.
That was something Miranda said to her cast on day one of shooting the sitcom. She said to them, I'm going to go quite big and quite stupid.
Yeah.
And you've got to come up and join me up there. Otherwise, I won't look good and you won't look good.
Yeah.
We've all got to get this. We're a little team, a little crew. We're all going to do the most pantomime, over the top, waving at the audience acting possible, but you've got to join me there because you won't look cool by not being part of this gang.
Can you imagine if they'd just taken Rick Mayall and gone, well, Rick, you're really, really funny, and AIDS great, but you're really funny, and here are four people that we found through a casting process to put next to you.
Yeah.
It's just that's not going to work.
It works when it's friends. One of the nicest things that can happen accidentally with casting, and it happened to us a couple of times, we've been really lucky with it, is that you get this list of what people want for their casting, and you go, oh, they're all really great, and then at the end, they're all unavailable, and you have to go, I'm sorry, it's only a week to go. We're getting our mates in.
Yeah.
They just knock it out of the park because they all know each other, they trust each other, and they're all on the mission together. And it's much better. I really like, at the last minute, recasting the entire thing with six people you've had a drink with.
I think this is why my live stuff has worked so well, is because it's people that I trust who all know each other and know that each other's funny. You know, if I've got Colin Holt on stage with Margaret Caborn Smith, they both know that they're funny. They both know that, you're right, they'll join the other one. And Colin doesn't break character. One of the things I love about him is he...
For weeks!
He doesn't. He's really... He takes himself really seriously as an actor. So if everybody else is mugging or breaking... Like when we did Gutted, there was... It got to a point where Humphrey Carr was in it, and he would come out on stage and go, well, it's just a play, isn't it? And it would... Oh, my God, it would drive me insane that he'd do that. Like, he would bail on it because it got... It, like, the production had so many problems. And Humphrey's instinct was to bail on it and say to the audience, I know this isn't working, I'm with you.
I'm in the lifeboats and I'm off.
Yeah.
Not women and children first, I'm going.
And Colin never, ever, ever did that. And
saluting,
that's why Colin,
on the prow like the captain.
That's why Colin was the funniest person in it, though, because when he stuck with it, the audience went with him.
We're coming back to the central core of what makes Bottom work, I think, is confidence and trust. And these two people know each other. And what you're enjoying watching it is two people who are leaning against each other in a trust exercise to say, no matter how stupid this gets, no matter how disgusting this gets, no matter how preposterous the next logical or illogical step in this story we've written is, we're going with it. And we dare you not to follow us.
I remember seeing Anna and Katie doing one of their sketch shows up in Edinburgh.
They're amazing.
They're so brilliant. Ed Bye directed their Channel 4 show.
Oh, yeah. There's a connection.
But because it was non-audience, I think they all found it a bit difficult because they'd be doing this non-audience thing and no one would go, that was really funny. So they'd be like, was this
Anna
funny?
Anna Crilly and Katie Wicks. That's really strange. They feel like best friends.
Yeah.
And I didn't realise when I first saw their first Edinburgh show, they'd only just met.
Yeah.
And it was like meeting two people from other sides of the world who speak some strange Navajo language that only 10 people speak. And you couldn't believe they'd got together because they dared the audience to not follow them.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's what I was going to say. I've sat in the audience and they did brilliantly. They had a Channel 4 series. Their show's got 5-star reviews. But I remember, I think it was their second Edinburgh show, got 1-star in The Scotsman because it was someone who didn't like it. And I remember going to see it and half the audience were pissing themselves and half the audience sat there in stony silence. And Anna and Katie's thing is, if you're not laughing, we will do this even more. Like, they double down on whatever they're doing with each other. You know, if the audience are losing patience, they sort of like meld into each other and go, we are doing this. And obviously they have the instinct to make the audience laugh as well, but I've never seen one of them leave the other one behind.
We are currently on a worldwide tour, basically just going all over the world and just measuring things.
36, the best of the day.
Okay, so tell me about your family.
My mother was 4'3", 500 paces between my room and my brother's room. 3 and inches, this is a measuring song!
Like, you would never get Anna saying to Katie, well, that didn't work, did it? That was rubbish. It would always be like, we are a team and this is, we are coming. It still frustrates me now that Anna and Katie haven't had their own sitcom. I've pitched so many things with them.
We did one.
Yeah, we wrote one.
It was going really well. Colin Holt in it. It was going to be amazing.
Oh, my God. That
Colin
sounds
dreamy. Demetrio, Jeff McGiven. It was brilliant. And then they just changed their mind overnight. They commissioned it and then they phoned us and went, we've decided not to. Went, oh, right. That was really good. They were lovely in it as well. But we were desperate to do something with them. They're the missing... I always think of them as a missing link. There's a whole generation who they would have been their French and Saunders.
Yeah.
and or they're Vic and Bob. It would have been amazing. And I love those two. But what you're talking about here is something which is really germane to Bottom, I think. The joy of watching this is two friends making each other laugh. Which, and that's pure.
So if you're listening to this wondering how to write comedy, it's have a really funny best friend.
Yeah.
I mean, that's it.
Well, you can ride on their coattails in one way, or you could both become as funny as each other.
I mean, it's odd, though. As writers, we come to this and we've gone, oh, isn't it brilliant when two brilliant performers just get each other? Because there's nothing that we as writers... I mean, you can shore it up a bit, but that's a... I can't bring that. That's as the writer, I can't do that.
One of the things that's really hard to admit as a writer, as a comedy writer, is collaboration is where a lot of the magic happens.
Mm.
And the trick is to find good collaborators, people you trust, and to do stuff in a group, because you can't do it on your own.
Yeah.
By definition.
I mean, I'm writing a play for Edinburgh this year that will star Anna Crilly and Margaret Caborn Smith.
There you go.
So exciting. So exciting. When you write for people that are funny and get your stuff and you get there, that's, as a writer, that's the best feeling. The worst thing is when you're brought on to work on a script with some actors that you don't know. They don't know you. No one really likes each other.
It's the difference between loving sex and porn. One of them is just faking it.
Yeah.
It's not real. And on that bombshell, surely we should say thank you very much, Daniel, for bringing
it on. Thanks, Daniel.
Bottom.
Oh, thanks.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.